Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Bill Malcolmson is speaking on creative aging, meaning. So let's listen in on Bill Malcolmson.
For our opening prayer, we're going to do a little different kind of prayer than you may be used to. According to Oswald, according to Oswald Sanders, this is a 17th century nun's prayer. I don't know if that's true or not. It sounds a little too contemporary to me, but it's something I think that is familiar to some of you. And I thought what we'd do is say this in unison. And it's okay to chuckle in the prayer. Go along. At least I hope it is. Lord, thou knowest better than I myself. Know that I am growing older and will someday be old. Keep me from the fatal habit of thinking I must say something on every subject and on every occasion. Release me from the craving to straighten out everybody's affairs. Make me thoughtful but not moody, helpful but not bossy. With my vast store of wisdom, it seems a pity not to use it all, but thou knowest, O Lord, that I want a few friends at the end. Keep my mind free from the recital of endless details. Give me wings to get to the point. Seal my lips on my aches and pains. They are increasing, and the love of rehearsing them is becoming sweeter as the days go by. I dare not ask for grace enough to enjoy the tales of others' pains, but help me to endure them with patience. I dare not ask for an improved memory, but for a growing humility and a lessening cocksureness when my memory seems to clash with the memories of others. Teach me the glorious lesson that occasionally I may be mistaken. Keep me reasonably sweet. I do not want to be a saint. Some of them are so hard to live with. But a sour old person is one of the crowning works of the devil. Give me the ability to see good things in unexpected places and talents in unexpected people. And give me, O Lord, the grace to tell them so. Amen. What do you think of that?
That's all right.
Who is the nun on the bottom?
That's the computer nun. Computer, word perfect.
Okay.
Word perfect designation.
I see.
My name is Bill Malcolmson. I'm not quite sure what my background is to teach something in creative aging. I usually have thought of myself as reasonably creative, and since I was born, I've been aging. So perhaps that is some qualification, at least.
You mind telling us your age?
62. I retired the end of 1993. My wife, Lori, is over here. Lori and I are the same age. Actually, she's 6 weeks older than I am and more mature in many, many ways. And she has worked professionally with older people as a social worker for all of her professional life, so I've learned a lot about I've learned a lot about aging from my wife.
Yeah.
So it turns out all right.
Careful.
Okay. I've been a seminary professor most of my professional life, and I was at the American Baptist Seminary of the West in Berkeley. I'm an American Baptist, ordained American Baptist minister. And so we lived in the Bay Area for many, many years. I was dean, I taught preaching and worship and church management and all this kind of stuff. And then I also worked with our denomination for a while, and I've been a pastor. I've been an associate pastor. Last job I had before I retired was I was interim senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in Greenwich Village in New York City. which was an experience somewhat different than what I'd had before. But then you were in India for a while, see, so you know, you need all these experiences. And I've been looking forward to this. I had no idea who was coming, but we can creatively age together. If you take this seriously, what we'll be doing here, I'll guarantee you will not be exactly the same at the finish as you were at the beginning. Nor will I. I can pretty reasonably guarantee that. My style is interactive. I don't get up or sit down and give lectures and long things about this, that, and the other thing. But we work with each other. If you have something to write on and something to write with, other than a lead fingernail, it would be probably helpful. Or if you can borrow from someone who is creatively carrying material with them, it would be good. I have some extra sheets of yellow paper here, but I don't have extra pen and pencil. Anyway, or you can contain this stuff in your mind too. That's another possibility. Now I've divided this into the five M's of aging creatively, as I call it. One thing you learn in the parish ministry is you have to come up with, right, Kent? You have to come up with titles that people remember. So this is another handout here. The original handout is a prayer that we repeated together that you missed, but you can repeat it to yourself. That's right, absolutely. I'm suggesting there are five M's of aging creatively: meaning, mortality, money, memory, and mission. And we're going to start out with meaning today and then go on. Each of these sessions, however, will be in and of itself, in a sense, so it isn't like they build on each other, though there's a certain amount of that, but we'll see how that goes. I want to start off our interaction on meaning by suggesting that all of us probably want our lives to count for something, that we all want to be important to someone. Where we differ is how we work this out, how we count and to whom we're important. Or to put it another way, you and I have a purpose or a cluster of purposes for being on this planet. And we discover what our meaning in life is by fulfilling these purposes. Someone has said that youth is wasted on young people. It really should come to those of us who are older, because then we can work out things like the meaning of life at a time when we should, rather than try to work it out much younger when we have no idea what we're doing. But no one said it was a bed of roses. Jesus, as you are well aware, had a sense of purpose which developed for him, and then he fulfilled these purposes in whatever he did. Now, I would hold that Jesus wrestled with the meaning of his life, and one way he did that was to come up with sort of images or words or phrases pulled together his meanings, like server. One of the things that he tried to do was to say to people, the core of living is to be a servant to all. They wanted to say, well, you mean, but you're Messiah, you should be on top of everything. And he said, no, servant. And he kept trying to say this because he discovered that the meaning of his life was to be service to all people, not to lord it over them, not to run their lives, not to be a kind of false authority. And that, so he lived his life and tried to help his disciples to live their lives with this core idea or this core image of servant. That sort of put together or pictured the meaning that he discovered in his life. Or another thing that did it for Jesus, what was another core?
Bread of life.
Bread of life, yeah, in the gospel, in the fourth gospel, you have a lot of these, the living water, you have light. These things were ways of saying this is what it's all about. These are the purposes in which he was involved. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about how I got onto this. Most of my professional life, as I say, I've been a teacher. I got into teaching really kind of by the side door. I got into teaching because I was a pastor in a local congregation in Connecticut, and the dean of Central Baptist Seminary in Kansas City, Kansas, came out there, and we, in the American Baptist denomination at that time, we had a directory of American Baptist ministers. And in that directory, it listed sort of areas in which you were supposedly had some expertise. And so when they were looking for people to take jobs, and I remember this was back in the, when was this, early 60s, when they were looking for people to take jobs. That's changed since, but, and so he remembered me from the directory, and he came to me as a pastor, and he said, be interested in having you teach at Central Seminary in Kansas City, Kansas. And I said, well, why? And anyway, so this finally worked out so that I actually did it. But I got into it not because I felt that I knew how to teach or not because I really had necessarily thought that that would be my life's work. So over a period of time of teaching, I finally discovered, in sort of a growing, gradual way, I finally discovered what it was that excited me most about teaching. And what it was that the one-on-one interaction, not just one-on-one in the office, but one-on-one in the classroom as well. And what I liked was to be able to encourage folks, stimulate, liberate, be a catalyst for people so that a new idea or a new way of looking at things or a new way of moving around in this world would come to them. And that to me was exciting. I taught preaching for a number of years, and I remember using videotape in teaching preaching and having students look at the videotape have you ever had that experience? The videotape after they preached, and all of a sudden, that's what I do. Oh, and it would change their whole way of doing it. I always found that very exciting to sort of be there at the moment when somebody clicked and turned around and went slightly different direction because that's where they needed to go then. So I began to look at myself as an encourager and a catalyst, a liberator, sort of a goad or a stimulus. And then I began to try to maximize the opportunity to do that because I felt that was really who I was. That was my purpose in life as a teacher, called to be a teacher by God to do this. And it helped me because then it meant there were a lot of other things I didn't have to do. There were a lot of ways of doing things I didn't have to try out because this is really who I was. And this was the... And wherever I was, I could do this, whether as a pastor or as a teacher or just as a friend or whatever, always tried to be fulfill what I thought was my vocation or my purpose. Now, I want you to get involved in this. And if you have a piece of paper in front of you and you have a pen to write with, Lori, since I want our relationship to last.
I haven't got a pen.
Let's use that. We've been married almost 39 years. I'd like for it to go on a little longer if it could. You have to pull the pen out.
Well, I'm trying.
Oh, I see. Well, the gentleman next to you will be your catalyst there. No, you open the notebook up. There you go.
Oh.
All right.
6-year-old.
Yeah. Well, we revert a little when we get older. We work through the 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 again. As you look at your life, and if you don't have something to write on just in your own mind, as you look at your life, what activities mean the most to you? What do you like to do best? What do you like to do best? What activities mean the most to you? Two or three of them. Then we'll talk about them a little bit.
I'm not really an extrovert, but I like small groups.
Okay. Why do you like small groups, do you think, Helen?
Well, there's more interaction.
Okay, and what do you get out of the interaction?
Where they're coming from.
So you learn from them?
Yes.
Okay. Are you a person who likes to learn from everything you're involved in?
I hate to think I wasn't.
Would it be fair to say that one of your sort of guiding principles in life is to be a learner?
Yes, and I like to stimulate others, not by words as much as by action.
Oh, like what?
Well, not setting an example, but trying to live a good life. And what is a good life?
What's wrong with setting an example? Oh, you mean you want to be more humble?
Well, not necessarily.
No.
But serving.
Serving, okay. Someone else, what are the two or three activities that you put down, or just one even?
Travel.
Travel. What is it about travel that you like?
Experiencing new places, people.
Uh-huh.
Beauty creation.
Yeah. Sort of a, what should we say, enhancing your appreciation of the world, or?
Increasing your awareness of it.
Awareness? Uh-huh. What travel experience has been one of the most changing that you've had?
I've led tours, about a dozen of them.
Yeah.
Probably the first one was to Israel. I probably had more influence all over.
Yeah. What was it particularly there that you...
Well, actually, to see the places that are mentioned in Scripture. I was sure initially that would spoil it for me. On the contrary, made it much more alive, much more real.
Why did you think it would spoil it?
I don't know. I was given money at one time by a class to send me over there.
Yeah.
And I declined to use it for that. I wasn't ready. I had a little bit of a dread of erasing all the things that I'd accumulated of impressions of the Lord and the land.
You didn't want the truth to actually interfere.
Well, I assumed that after this many years, 2,000, let's say, for Jesus, they wouldn't be the same anyway.
Well, that's true, of course. Yeah, right. I had a very similar experience, and I had seen so many pictures of my trip to the Holy Land that I wanted to make sure I didn't do that. That was part of my negative feeling about going over.
Yeah.
I've showed a few pictures since of my trip to the Holy Land, but of course, it's a very selected group. Anybody else? What are some of the activities?
He's my brother, and so I do love to travel, but mainly to scenic places rather than historic places.
Oh, why is that?
And because I just love nature and scenery. Uh-huh. I'm not all that turned on by history.
Well, I need an expert photographer.
Uh-huh. And then I like to take pictures and try to really do some creative photography. Uh-huh. And in the last couple of years, I've had the extreme pleasure of traveling with a grandchild.
Oh, wow.
Grandson on three, four different trips now.
Oh, yeah.
And that has really opened up a lot of, I don't know what he learns from me and I learn from him, but camp together, sleep in the same tent.
How old is he?
Well, they were from 11 to 13.
Oh, that's a great age.
And,
still a sense of wonder that they have.
Yeah.
Everything new.
After our first trip, this one grandson said, "I'd like to see the Grand Canyon." You know? And that was our principal goal this last summer in June.
Yeah.
Although we visited some 20 major attractions. Coming and going.
Now, what did he do when he saw the Grand Canyon?
Pardon?
What? How did he react when he saw the Grand Canyon?
He was very impressed. It was, what is the word they use nowadays?
Awesome.
Awesome. Yeah. Now, this is the shorter term.
Cool.
I have a grandson too. Same words.
Yeah.
Well, to top it off, he has pictures and blown up. And he gives the youngsters an album of all the places they've done with.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. You are a teacher. Do you identify with nature? That is, do you feel like a part of it, a sense of connection, or when you're out in the...
I would say there is a sense of connection. Some people, once in the village, we were asked, you know, where do you feel closest to God?
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people felt closest to God in a place like this.
Yeah.
And I think that's a part of it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
One person felt closest to God when he thought about his baptism, of all things.
Is that right?
He was the leader.
Oh, yeah. I think I might pick the Grand Canyon first.
By the way, just a note, if you get up to the Mayan Museum, there are three huge albums of colored pictures that he took and donated to the village.
Oh, okay.
It's worth paging through there.
All right.
You've been here for 4 or 5 years.
Okay. Let's shift a little bit. And if you were to pick on one or two, let's call them truths, T-R-U-T-H-S, or insights, if you wish, that are crucial to you, that are really, wow, this is it. This is really important to me. I can't live without this one. What would be an example of that?
You know, I was thinking, I'm at the point in my life now where I'm just beginning to think, what has my life really stood for?
Welcome to the group.
Probably a transition time for me. I'm 53 and thinking of retiring at 55.
Yeah.
I'm just beginning to think of all these changes. And I have grandchildren now, and there's changes because of that and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so probably never have really formulated in my mind what have I stood for the first 53 years of my life. You know, how you get caught up in the activities of family life.
Right. Right.
And all of those things.
Right. So you're in the process of working on what are these truths I want to hold on to or have learned? Or
right.
Have you come to any
up to this point, my life is, I'm really kind of a homebody. I mean, I probably don't enjoy traveling as much as some other people, although I have, and it hasn't really hit me like these people. But I enjoy being at home. I enjoy family and friends and church, the stable things of life.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The things that I can do where I am at my place. You might say.
You so like security,
yeah? I would think so, yeah. That's probably a basic truth, is that that's the type of person that I am.
Yeah. Do you feel at home in the world, so to speak? That is, do you feel like... you know, this, or let's try this. Is the image of home a real important one for you?
That's probably the overriding thing for me. We've taken one big trip, so I'm no expert on it. We went to Sweden and Norway this spring, and I have to confess that I felt a little ill at ease, during that 2 weeks that we were there. You know, although that's where my roots are, and we met family and.
Yeah.
So on while we were there, but
it wasn't home.
That wasn't home.
Right. Yeah. I think personally, I think that the image of home is an image that is one of the three or four what Jung would call archetypal images for us, and that a lot of religion, as a matter of fact, is based on what is home. What is it that makes us feel like? we're okay in this universe. like there's someone here who loves us, or there is something that is ultimately all right. Because I think part of the image of home is safe, is it's basically all right. Whatever happens, there's some place to come to. I am loved.
Yep, but yet I see the other side of the coin too, and that we have a responsibility, I think, to break those lesions. And
sure.
That's, we have to be intentional about that. We can't spend.
Right. The flip side of that, you can get very happy in your home, and you can get nested and settled in, and say, I found it at 55. I found it. Yeah. Okay. Someone else. Yeah. Crucial truth or crucial image is all right. A crucial understand. Yeah, Laura.
Well, self-determination.
Huh.
Yes, or whatever that means. I mean, in retirement, I don't have to do this, that, or anything. I can choose where I spend my time and my energy. That's very important to me.
Uh-huh.
The opportunity to be by myself is very important. Something I didn't have a lot of when I was working, as well as the opportunity to serve, but areas of my choosing. Uh-huh.
Well, that certainly rings true the way I know you. Okay. Yes?
I've had a great spiritual journey, and there are many things that
sure.
go along through life, but the last 5 years or so, I've experienced a day a week with an Alzheimer respite group.
Yes.
And I've learned, how meaningful the past is to them,
uh-huh.
and the future means nothing,
uh-huh.
but the moment.
Uh-huh.
And it's a matter of living in the moment.
Uh-huh.
I have a little cross-stitch thing on my door up in Lodge 1 that says, life has its moments. It does have. But
there's a lot in that phrase.
They're very responsive if you give them a chance.
Uh-huh.
And,
uh-huh.
They're not worrying uh-huh. about yesterday or tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
It's right then, and they're very responsive to what you're doing at the time.
Uh-huh.
We have lots of fun,
uh-huh.
just lots of fun.
One of the things that happened to me in retirement, and I haven't been retired but since the end of December, is, and I didn't realize this would happen. I guess I didn't think it through well enough, but the realization that I can sit in the chair out in front of the house, and I can look at the Japanese maple there, and I look at the bird bath, and I can watch the birds and the bird feeder, and that's okay because there's nothing else I really have to do. And all that kind of burden of, well, I really should be doing this, or when I was working, I think, well, now, that bush over there really needs to be trimmed, and it's, I've got to get it done this weekend, because if I don't get it done this weekend, the next weekend, you know what I mean? And the realization, no, I actually can sit there and live in that moment.
I have a problem with having to accomplish something to feel good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Flipping a bush, maybe, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you can't really relax in the moment, can you? Because you're sitting there thinking, that really needs to be done. And this
I found one cure for that. I carry a little piece of paper and write down the thing I should be doing. And then relax.
Do you burn that then?
Eventually I get real ambitious. But that works for me.
I love that. I'm going to try that next time I feel guilty. What two or three personality characteristics do you affirm as central to who you are? This is just all the ways of getting at the same thing. Anybody who hasn't said something so far, what two or three personality, or just one even, that you say, hey, this is me, this is what I'm like?
And really a cause a bit of distress for me was, who am I
uh-huh.
when I'm not in ministry?
Right.
I'm so used to being at the beck and call of others.
Yeah.
That I was wondering now, what's going to happen when I'm not?
When nobody's becking and calling.
Yeah, you're talking about sitting on a porch and looking and,
right.
Taking in nature and all that. I like to do that too, but in the process, I think for a long while, I was thinking I should be doing something else. I wasn't comfortable.
There's someone you should be calling on.
Yes.
That's right.
That's right.
Or there's a sermon you should be working on.
That's right. And so my difficulty was making the transition.
Yeah.
And whereas now I haven't that difficulty because I'm doing part-time the thing I really love to do at a church. So that makes a difference.
Yeah.
I have both worlds now. I can do the kinds of things that I enjoy doing, and I still have the freedom and flexibility of a schedule. Another thing I was thinking about in terms of personality characteristics that are important to me, central. And I guess I'm committed to striving for those things by the grace of God. And that is to be open and to be accepting and to be affirming. Accept where people are coming from, realizing they may not be where I am. And
probably
and
aren't.
And it may be a good thing. And to be affirming of another person, where that person happens to be. Uh-huh. And somehow, I guess it's being an encourager, a person who can be with people and can support people where they are. Uh-huh. Hopes together we journey. And I've come to believe that whatever spiritual journey I happen to be on is not one that I'm on by myself.
Amen. Oh, yeah.
It's with others.
Beautiful.
When it comes to knowing yourself, I read a book not long ago where the author felt or insisted that we needed to spend more time in meditation. Three times a day, 15 minutes is
my
what he
Lord.
Suggested. And start by relaxing, think of your breathing, and he gives you all the sort of things you can do. And that sort of balances this need to always be on the go.
Yeah.
And still, on the other side of that coin, as the older you get, the more easy it is just to sit, you know, and do nothing. And it takes extra energy to get out there. And as you do that, maybe watch too much of the tube, life gets pretty boring.
Or go to sleep.
And then I like to say, so if you're bored, it's nobody's fault but your own. Do something.
Right. Yeah. One of the distinctions, and I'm sure that most of you are familiar with this, but one of the distinctions that's often helpful in this is the distinction between being and doing. It came up when you were saying, tell me your first name, please.
When.
When you were saying that you feel guilty if you're not doing something, I think particularly for men in our society, though it's becoming more and more the case for women, there has been a focus on you are what you accomplish, right?
Yes.
You are what you do, and the more you accomplish, the better person you are. Part of it, I think, is the American culture, which is growth-oriented, that if you can do three things well, you ought to learn to do five things well. Or if you can get, if you can convince six people that they should buy such and such, it's even more important if you can convince 10. So it's sort of this accumulation of meaning through more and more accomplishment, more and more success, and kind of building that up. So if the emphasis is on doing, so that when someone comes to you and says, what do you do? You know, what do you do for a living? Not who are you, but what do you do for a living, you see? And I always cringe, as a minister, I always cringe, particularly if it happened on an airplane, when people would do that. But nonetheless, so the doing emphasis, the accomplishment, one of the problems, of course, with that is it isn't always clear as to why this accomplishment is significant, other than it's an accomplishment of some kind. Why is it important to do this? Are some things more important than others? Are some things that not everybody thinks is wonderful really significant to do? Is it good to do some things and never get any recognition? Is it, and part of the problem with so much emphasis on doing is that it never ends, right? I mean, you can always do something else. I thought about the calling. My father was a parish minister, and I know Dad is dead now, but he lived with the guilt that there's always someone else he could call on. Now, this was in an era when people were at home, and you could actually go and call them. Now, the guilt, you know, has really diminished a lot because they're not there anyway, and even if they are, they don't want you to show up. So it's some advantage for those who are not into calling. But anyway, Dad lived with that guilt for many, many years. I know, there's always some, or someone else you could help. You know, somebody you could connect with. And maybe, and it's a trap because it never stops. And yet, the other side of it, I like, you and I think the same way we think, now what's the other side, the flip side of it. The other side of that is that there is a lot to be said for a stewardship of your talents, for being willing to use what you have, right? I mean, it's better than just sitting around not doing a thing, isn't it? And so to really learn what you do well and to maximize that and to do it and to accomplish things, I mean, why else are we on this earth if not to accomplish something at least instead of just vegetate? So there's a lot of insight into that. But then there's also the business of being. You know, I remember I had a secretary one time, but I didn't have a secretary. She was a secretary in the place where I worked. Terrible way to think. And that probably tells something right there is how one thinks of things. But anyway, there was a secretary there. And I used to say to her, you know, you're really hired for who you are more than what you do. Now, she was the kind of person who could take that well because she knew it didn't mean what you do is really awful, but it was rather, you know, you are really valued here for who you are. And it was true, she did what she did well, but her main contribution to that environment, at least, was who she was. And this sort of spilled over so that when she was there, the atmosphere changed for the good. And it was a positive atmosphere. And people loved coming into her office. People loved talking with her because they were always listened to. They were always heard. It was always an exciting thing. But you could say, in a sense, she didn't really do a lot. Or at least that wasn't how people thought of her. Okay, she did a lot, but it wasn't how people thought. It was who she was. And so the emphasis there is more on being. And I think one of the things that happens to us when we age is that in a way we're moving sort of from, a little bit at least, from the doing era into the being era. Now that's superficial in a way, but not totally, is it? I mean, you were wrestling with this, when. How do you move from the, I judge myself by what I accomplish, to I judge myself by who I am, maybe that's more frightening. Maybe who I am isn't that exciting. It would be easier to do it by what I did.
Yeah. Maybe what we're doing is more combining doing with being as well.
I hope so, right? Yeah. Yeah, I like that better, because when Lori and I talk about this, Lori will, I know it. I don't know what she's thinking, but I know a little bit what I think she's thinking. What I think you're thinking is you're saying to yourself, you're a doer. Uh-huh. Yeah. And you don't know what I mean when I say emphasis on being, right? Do you know what I mean?
Sometimes.
Someone had a group of older people that were being escorted through the Senate and the House of Representatives, yeah, and so forth, and very patronizing to these old people. He talked real loud, made sure they could hear.
Yeah, right.
Now
right.
Them as little
right.
People.
Right.
Finally, he turned to one of them and said, "What did you used to be?"
What did you used to be? Yeah, my heavens.
He said, "I still am."
Very. I love it. What did you used to be? That's a great, I'll remember that one. That's a great phrase. Well, I used to be really a rotten person, but now I'm a wonderful human being. Right. You should have known me then. What would it mean to you to move from more of an emphasis on doing and or judging yourself by doing, let's put it that way, to more of an emphasis on judging yourself more on who you are? What would that feel like? Would that be sounding like a good thing, or is that kind of a weird idea, or does it make any sense at all?
I think we add the Christ dimension, who I have become, uh-huh. is not my doing, but it is a gift by the goodness of the Lord,
uh-huh.
whose pattern was, I came not to be ministered unto,
uh-huh.
and that's also to be mine, and that to the extent that it is, it's his doing.
Uh-huh.
And that's a development process,
uh-huh.
which will not be perfect till I get to glory.
Are you saying then that in a way, the emphasis on being is also an emphasis more on receiving?
Well, it has to be both, of course.
Well, but I mean that there is an when you emphasize the being part of it, you're emphasizing the gift part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? You're emphasizing the receiving part of it. You're emphasizing that in religious terminology, you're emphasizing being a part of the will of God, as opposed to saying, "Now, God, this is what you're supposed to do."
Which, after receiving, leads to giving.
Right. Sure. Exactly. And you, as you or somebody was saying, there is a balance here between being and doing. What I'm really saying, I think, is that for a lot of people in our society, the balance has been way too much on one side. And when you retire, particularly, and you're not hired to do anything, does the meaning go? You see, does it? And it's what you were wrestling with, Ken. Does the meaning go then? Because you would put so much emphasis on.
Well, it's a question too
that.
About the poor in our society.
Mm-hmm.
How do we value the poor?
Yeah, who are not doing anything.
They're not doing anything.
Yeah.
So
right.
Obviously they're not as important as those who are doing something.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that our Christian orientation would say it's not the matter of whether or not they're doing anything. They're important because of who they are.
Yeah. I think it comes through even more, if I may, Ken, in persons who are ill.
Yes, that's another thing.
Because I know in Greenwich Village, I found that the people who were poor were working night and day. They weren't working like you and I think of working. they were surviving by begging, it wasn't just a 9-to-5 job. It was continual doing things.
I guess
things.
I would think about productivity.
I understand.
Sense, yeah.
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
But Viktor Frankl, you know, who was the lived through the Holocaust or lived through the camps and was a psychiatrist. Frankl says that for a lot of people in our society, and he was thinking particularly of the ill, the terminally ill and the chronically ill, people in our society, their basic accomplishment is to get through the day. That is to endure, to make it through that period of time with some dignity. And you see, but we don't tend to think of that as an accomplishment. But yet, what I think what he was trying to say was that to do that, in a sense, is another form of accomplishment. I think, personally, that it's helpful to celebrate who we are as persons, celebrate our being, if you have. That each person is incredibly significant. I'm sure hope Christians think this. Each person is incredibly significant in and of themselves, even if they don't do a blessed thing. Because if you look at it this way, if say God judges you the way the culture judges you, God were to judge us, suppose God were to judge us like the culture judges, right? Suppose God were to say, well, you know, when you did all right, basically, but you know, there's a lot of stuff you left out. And there are things you could do that, and you're sort of, you're above 50 on my scale of values here in the Lamb's Book of Life, you know, you're about in the middle of the page. You know, there are people who are, I mean, you could have done more. And here's some suggestions, maybe, even as to what you could do. Yeah, and before, well, before you, you know, kick off at 95, before you, you bite the big one at that age, here's a, you know, 20 or 30 things I'd like to have you accomplish. Suppose God thought of us that way, or suppose there was a cutoff point in terms of accomplishments. It's like saying, you know, here's paradise. Now you're going to make it to paradise if you do 4,383 good things in your life. 4,382 doesn't make it, but 4,383, that's the cutoff point. You go from there as gravy. If God really looked at things that way, which is the way a lot of the culture does look at it, doesn't it? Sort of, you know, you've got to accomplish as much as possible. You've got to really make it. You've got to have what? How many children? How many houses? How much money? And so on.
Well, this is why older people are looked down upon, because they're not producing.
They're not producing.
Creative. They're not contributing.
That's right. They're receivers. They're getting all the Social Security money that our children are going poor on paying in. Yes. I went, Laurie and I were in the Catskills a couple years ago, and we were went to this hotel, and they were having a seminar, which I'll never forget the name of, that this guy was teaching, remember, called How to Spend Your Children's Inheritance. Maybe you've been to one of them. And his theory was, he said, why should they spend it? They didn't earn it. Mm-hmm. And I said, you've earned it. Mm-hmm. You should spend it. I thought, boy, there's the American way for you, right down the wire, right? Don't, and certainly don't give it to anybody, you know. Don't help anyone out, but just make sure that you earned it. You spend it. How to spend your children's
inheritance. The bumper sticker on a recreational vehicle, I'm spending my children's inheritance.
Yes, that's right.
Not really.
No, I'm afraid not. Let's try this one. This may seem a little strange, but it's maybe the easiest thing we do, or maybe not. As you look over your day, I realize no one ever has an average day, but if you look over your day, what is the most important time of the day to you? What is the most important time? I can tell you mine, to kick it off. You're not going to be surprised at that.
Yeah, no, you're going to steal mine.
Yeah, right. It's eating breakfast, sitting in the chair in the this comfortable chair. We have one comfortable chair in the whole place. Sitting in the chair and reading the New York Times in the morning. That's my best time of the day.
Well, you know what the seniors' happy hour is?
What's that?
Nap time.
Nap time. Okay, what's the favorite time of the day for how about one of you folks in the back here having some?
Probably in the morning.
Yeah.
Having my cup of coffee, and I read a devotional, and and just getting ready for the day, which isn't too eventful sometimes.
But you know, that's interesting, because I would connect with the phrase you used, getting ready for the day. Because as I thought about this, I thought that's really what I'm doing. By reading the New York Times, or whatever paper, but though the New York Times is certainly the best paper in the world, but nonetheless, sitting reading the New York Times, I'm sort of connecting with the day. I'm saying, you know, I'm involved now. I mean, I'm thinking about what's going on in the world. I feel like I'm using my mind rather than just sitting there going like this. And yeah, it's getting ready for the day, isn't it? It's sort of preparing for. Is there anybody for whom the best time of your day is at the end?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Now, sometimes that's because it's a time to reflect on the day, or it's a sense of, yeah, okay, that was that.
Did you accomplish what you had thought you would in the morning?
Now, when you find out you didn't, how do you feel?
I'll think about tomorrow.
You got this worked out. I can sense this. Yeah, there's no. You figured that one out very well. We have three more, 2.5 minutes. I want to ask you now: is there any particular in this hour we've had together? Is there any particular new idea that came to you? Something that you hadn't really thought this way quite before? Anybody that new idea that had come to you that you'd say, oh, that's, I haven't quite figured that out. I haven't quite clicked on that one.
I got one with a question mark after it.
That's the best new idea there is.
When you said bite the big one.
Oh, that means die. I hope that's not the only insight you got.
Probably haven't verbalized it, but the transition from doing to being.
Uh-huh.
Right. Although we didn't talk about how do you
right.
How do you do that?
No, I just introduced it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
With that idea.
Thank you.
I think of it as a combination of the two. Because I was a teacher and I keep repeating to myself mentally the idea, once a teacher, always a teacher. I was kind of jealous when I would see children and wasn't doing something with them.
Yes.
And I was wondering if they were reading that story with
right.
them, doing this
right.
with them. So
but I'll forth. Bet, how long have you been retired?
What?
How long have you been retired?
22 years.
But I'll bet you're still a teacher. because I know teaching well enough, I think, to know that in teaching there's an awful lot of being. In fact, that the major communication you make is not something you do. The major influence that you've had on people over the years, I know the major influence I've had, people over the years, I don't count in terms of doing, count in what they remember is who you are. What they remember, it's weird, isn't it?
I've kept
stuff you've forgotten, mother, they'll remember.
The mothers and folks sent, wrote to me about it.
Yeah.
Influence I had my children.
Probably something you weren't aware of at the time, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Because I was a doer.
Yeah. Well, you were a beer, too. Yes.
I picked up one thing in a another class that we had the other day. Mm-hmm. It was a discussion of Madeleine L'Engle.
Yes.
Okay. She had the thought there that she tried to hang her cares on the cross at 5 o'clock. She had a specific time. And she was practicing giving up being a doer and becoming a beer.
At 5 o'clock. Boy, if you can program your life that way, then that's good.